You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. In June, we featured a program that raised the question, can the president pardon himself? Tonight, we take a broader look at the upcoming presidential year. With a new Democratic Congress, the ongoing Russia investigation, and an ongoing reboot of high-level White House staff, even cabinet officers, what are we to expect in the coming year? If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us right here in the studio is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local calling area, again, that's outside of San Francisco, please call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. With me tonight, we're fortunate to have with us Jamal H. Anderson has served as a Deputy San Mateo District Attorney since 2014. Prior to becoming an attorney, Jamal worked for a number of elected officials in Washington, D.C., including Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, as she transitioned from Minority Leader to Speaker, Congresswoman Jackie Speier, and Congressman Gwen Moore. Jamal also served as Federal Affairs Advisor to the former Mayor of Washington, D.C., Adrian Fenty, and worked on the 2004 presidential campaign of Governor Howard Dean. Dean Johnson is an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on both television and radio of both legal and political matters, as well as the founder of Pundit Network. A former prosecutor, Mr. Johnson practices criminal defense and civil litigation in both state and federal courts. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number to us, again, right here in the studio, is 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Let me welcome each of you, Dean, Jamal.
Hey, Jeff. Nice to be here again.
Thank you for having me.
About this point, I always begin the show by saying I'd like to start here. But here we have so many developments. Where can we start? Where should we start? Some basic questions. Why are people racing for the sidelines? When we're looking at the administration, is the ship sinking, or is it just that the president himself is a very difficult employer for whom to work? And before we go on, general questions. What effect might happen when one, but only one, House of Congress shifts away from the president's party? Where's the Mueller investigation now, and where's it going? What flows from such unilateral decisions as the withdrawal from Syria or distancing ourselves from our traditional allies? Those are more political questions, but with those things in mind, the ultimate question is whether the Senate's likely to continue to support the president. Now, with those things in mind, I'd like to start here. Dean, when you were on the show some months back, we were talking about the Mueller investigation and the role of the independent counsel. And you answered a very simple question. Can we indict a sitting president? Have your views on that changed any?
Well, no, not at all. And understand, we're talking about unexplored territory here. My view is that the president, a sitting president, probably cannot be indicted, but the support for that is extremely sketchy. There is a clause in the impeachment portion of the Constitution that talks about the process of impeachment. And it says in its very last sentence, it says, those convicted, that is, those who are removed from office by the impeachment process, may then be subject to trial, judgment, prosecution, and so on. So I think what the framers of the Constitution had in mind was not that a sitting president or any sitting federal officer be indicted, but that the impeachment process go forward, and then should the person be removed from office after a trial in the Senate, then they could be subject to criminal prosecution. Of course, that raises a lot of issues. If prosecutors like Bob Mueller are required to wait for the impeachment process to run its course before they indict? Do statutes of limitations run? Some of the things we're talking about in the Mueller investigation happened 3 or 4 years ago. The default statute of limitations in federal litigation is 5 years. So people who might be indicted and might be removed from office, and we won't name any names just yet, might escape on a statute of limitations ground. There are also questions about, well, that governs federal law, but then what about state prosecutions? We know that presidents can be sued civilly in state court, even as they sit in the office of the president. Can a sitting president be prosecuted by a state like, say, New York? And if that's true, then do we have double jeopardy problems where there are possible parallel federal and state prosecutors? The issues go on and on. And I have to say, I emphasize again that with all of these issues, we're not walking on concrete. We don't have precedents. We don't have a lot of historical background. We're walking into new territory every day. And in many ways, that's what makes this so interesting.
Jamal, what are your thoughts about that, about indicting a sitting president?
Well, Jeff, I think with regards to the potential indictment of a sitting president, I think the Office of Legal Counsel has been clear, and I think most legal commentators have indicated that there is current policy in place that precludes the indictment of a sitting president. And I think that is probably going to hold. I think the interesting question, which I'm sure we'll get to shortly with regards to the Mueller investigation, is really a political question. It is really whether or not there will be, with the change of power in the House, a movement to, in fact, impeach the president. But with regards to the issue in terms of the potential indictment of the president, I think, at least as it relates to where we are now, that's a fairly resolved issue, even though people have differing opinions on it. And I think the more interesting thing will be to see what the House ultimately chooses to do politically.
Yeah, I tend to agree. There is, in the Justice Department manuals, there's a policy. A special prosecutor arguably doesn't even have to follow that policy. But remember, we're dealing with Bob Mueller here. He's a lifelong prosecutor, a career prosecutor. And even if there were an argument, which there probably is, that a sitting president could be indicted, Bob Mueller won't, because, quite frankly, a dedicated public servant like that is going to say, look, this is way over my pay grade. The decision about whether to do something that could potentially remove a president from office shouldn't be made by one person. It shouldn't be a prosecutor's decision. It shouldn't be a public servant's decision. It should go to the body that most closely represents the will of the people. And first and foremost, it needs to go to the Congress. So those people, and I know there's some of you out there who have this vision of Donald Trump being perp-walked out of the White House, it ain't going to happen that way.
You both brought up Robert Mueller. Where do you see the Mueller investigation? I mean, where are we now? Where's that all going?
It's following the trajectory of a typical federal prosecution. 90% of the time, if you have federal prosecutors looking into a complex case, a high-profile case, they're going to start with the little fish, and they're going to work their way up to the big fish. And that's exactly what's been happening here. If we can remember back months ago, we heard about first the indictment of George Papadopoulos, and 99.9% of us said, who's George Papadopoulos? And we later found out. And progressively, as the indictments have come down, we've gotten closer and closer and closer to the big fish, encircling what may be the biggest fish of all. And that's the way these federal prosecutions go. I suspect that there will be more indictments, people at a higher level, people possibly closer to the president. But eventually, the last indictment will come down. And what we're all really waiting for is we're waiting for that final shoe to drop. The special prosecutor, by statute, is required to make a report to the Attorney General, to the Congress. That becomes a matter of public record, and that the content of that report is going to lead to precisely the political process that Jamal talked about earlier. Once that information is available, depending on what it says about the president, whether he's once again implicated in a felony as he was in the Southern District prosecutions, if he's designated as an unindicted co-conspirator, as Richard Nixon was, or if he's referred to as individual number one again and described as aiding and abetting a crime, then I think it falls upon the Congress to make the decision about whether to start the impeachment process. And that's where the political ramifications of this become extremely interesting.
Well, I would add to that that we don't know. I mean, there are things that have occurred in the past couple of weeks that have given us a better sense of the direction of the investigation and where things are going. But Dean mentioned Bob Mueller a moment ago. And Bob Mueller, by every indication, is a consummate professional. And because of his professionalism, there is a lot that we actually don't know. It's been an investigation that has been without leaks for all the right reasons, given the sensitivity of the investigation. But we do know and have been able to glean some things from the documents that have been offered by the special counsel with regards to the sentencings or the aborted sentencing in the case of Michael Flynn. We know, going back to the sentencing of Michael Cohen, who was sentenced to 3 years in prison a number of weeks back, there was information that he allocated with regards to the president's involvement as individual one that gives us some indication of other shoes that may potentially drop. We have, of course, the ongoing issues with regards to Paul Manafort, the breach of his plea agreement. He, of course, is set for sentencing on March the 5th of 2019. And one of the interesting points with regards to him has to do with the fact that the special counsel's office has filed under seal information with the federal judge in that case, which details how, in fact, he breached the agreement. Essentially, they are alleging that he has lied to them. And of course, the fact that many of those documents are redacted suggests that there is a lot of information that is left to be determined. The same is true for Michael Flynn, who was set to be sentenced on December 18th. He entered into an agreement, or at least had an understanding with the federal prosecutors or the special counsel's office, that he might receive a probationary or non-custodial sentence. The sentencing guidelines in that case ranged from 0 to 6 months. But when he went to be sentenced with the judge in that case, Emmett Sullivan, the judge was not able to guarantee him that he would in fact receive a non-custodial sentence, and he therefore decided to postpone that sentencing. One of the interesting things that occurred, though, during the course of that proceeding was that special counsel's office made clear that Michael Flynn had participated in at least 19 interactions with them, which obviously means that he has provided a lot of information to the special counsel's office, which allowed them to make a determination that a probationary sentence would be appropriate. And again, there were other redacted documents that were filed in that case. So I say that to say there is a lot of information that is left unknown to us at this point. But I think it's fair to say that we are probably coming, hopefully, to a fairly swift conclusion. I think many experts, and Dean would agree, have suggested that we might see a report within the next few months, perhaps as early as the end of February. But there are still a lot of shoes in the air.
Well, Jamal is correct. You know, the word that was used during the Flynn sentencing was substantial assistance. And in federal law, that's a code word. It's what we lawyers call a term of art. In real terms, what that means is that Michael Flynn is singing like a canary. He's giving a lot of information to prosecutors. The question we don't know, because Bob Mueller has really pulled it off here. He has kept his prosecution secret. He has sealed up all the leaks, which in this day and age is just remarkable. But the question we don't know is, and the bottom line here, is what does Robert Mueller have on the president, if anything? He's already been named as individual number one, as a potential suspect. But the violations there are campaign violations. Yes, they're crimes. But are they the kinds of crimes that are going to have, to use a phrase that we lawyers use, jury appeal? And the jury in this case is the United States Senate. And it, whatever he's got, the case has to be rock solid, and it has to be convincing enough to shift 20 senators, because you need two-thirds of the Senate to convict ultimately in a trial, if there's going to be an impeachment process at all. We haven't seen that yet. We don't know if we're going to see that. So that's why when that report comes out, it's going to be scoured over by every politician and reporter in the United States time after time after time to see if there is enough there. And that's going to shift the balance of power. Now, to go back to our original question, how do all these other things, how does the chaos that we're looking at right now politically affect that? Economic downturn, government shutdown, Syrian backlash, all of that becomes background. It becomes a background that changes the tipping point for potential, frankly, Republican senators to make a decision as to whether being identified with Donald Trump is a political asset or a political liability. If things in the broader political world are not going well, as they appear to be for Trump right now, then the case, the senators will be more, I think, inclined to listen to arguments for impeachment. The bar will be lower, but if things are going well, the bar to any sort of impeachment process would be extremely high.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco, where we're discussing the upcoming presidential year. I'm Jeff Hayden, and here in the studio with me tonight, I have Dean Johnson, an Emmy Award-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and radio of both legal and political matters, and Jamal H. Anderson, who has extensive experience in Washington, D.C. and on Capitol Hill before serving as a deputy San Mateo County District Attorney. You can call regarding any question on the topic, not necessarily limited to the exact point in the conversation we are, of course. If you have questions for my guests, the phone number to us here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. Again, 866-798-8255. So we've begun talking amongst ourselves about the Mueller investigation. As it sits today, do you believe, and I'll start with you, Jamal, do you think that the president will sit down with Robert Mueller?
Based on the information that we have as of now, I don't believe that he will. Certainly his attorney, or one of his attorneys, Rudy Giuliani, has indicated recently that the president would likely not sit down for an interview. We do know that the president did respond to a series of questions that were asked of him by the special counsel's office about a month ago. I would assume that based on those responses, the special counsel's office will probably seek to clarify information as they continue to gather information from those individuals like Michael Cohen and like Michael Flynn, who have indicated that they are going to cooperate with the investigation. And I would imagine that the special counsel's office will compare the information that they are receiving from those cooperators with the answers that have been provided by the president. And then the special counsel's office will then seek additional information. But at this point, I do not believe that the president will actually sit down with the special counsel's office. And I would assume that his attorneys have advised him as such.
Dean, do you see it any differently? I mean, do you think that Robert Mueller is going to try to compel the president to appear in person and answer questions? And if he does, what do you think happens if Trump refuses?
Well, I think it's certainly possible. To follow up on what Jamal is saying, I think the advice is correct. This appear before this the special counsel for the president is a very high risk and very low reward proposition. However, we're not talking about your typical client. We're talking about Donald Trump. If I were his lawyer, I would try to tie him to a chair, but I don't think that's even going to help. People like Donald Trump are the toughest clients you can possibly have. Usually men who are rich, who are powerful, and who are used to getting their way and who think they can talk their way out of anything. And they always want to have that opportunity. So it's possible that Donald Trump will just ignore the advice of his counsel and talk to the special counsel anyway. But to get to the other question, would Mueller try to compel Trump at this point? I think it really depends on where the prosecution is. If Mueller thinks that he has a solid case against everyone that he wants to indict, whether that includes the president or not, I don't think he's going to risk a constitutional crisis by subpoenaing the president and having him refuse and having us relitigate Nixon versus United States. If he needs that piece of the puzzle, he's going to do what police officers, FBI, and investigators do all the time. He will invite the president to come and sit down, try to compel him if he can, but only if there's an essential piece of that puzzle that that Mueller doesn't have yet, and if it's only if it's something that he can get only from sitting down and talking to the president. I would say the probability of that happening at this point, at this stage of the prosecution, since it hasn't happened already, I'd say the probability is very low.
You mentioned Nixon versus United States. To the non-lawyers that are listening tonight, can you give a real brief rundown of what you meant?
Sure. That was a constitutional crisis case. Nixon was subpoenaed to produce certain records, tapes to a special prosecutor. He refused, and the case went up to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, yes, the president can be subject to subpoena, but there's a fairly high bar. You have to consider the necessity for the evidence, secrecy and executive privilege issues and so on. But yes, the president, like all the rest of us, is subject to subpoena by a prosecutor.
Do you see it any differently, Jamal? Do you believe that the special prosecutor will try to subpoena the president?
I actually do not. I mean, we've talked a bit about Bob Mueller, former director of the FBI under multiple presidents, who is, again, a consummate professional. And I do not believe that at this point he would risk the perceived integrity of his process, which has been impeccable by most standards, by plunging the investigation into a constitutional crisis. I think what we would see happen if he sought to subpoena the president, obviously the president's legal team would fight that, and we might very well end up in front of the Supreme Court. And of course, given the recent appointments to the Supreme Court, and this, of course, is not to say that the president's appointees would side with him automatically because they appointed him, but we run the risk of having a situation that is very confrontational, that is very loaded, hearkening back to the Gore-Bush decision in 2000. And I don't think that Bob Mueller would like to see us go there. I assume he has enough information at this point to provide to Congress without the president sitting down with him. Would he like to sit down with the president? I'm sure he would. But I don't think that he's going to go down that road at this point.
You know, it's interesting that you raised the Supreme Court. We talk about Nixon versus the United States. One of the things that has changed since the last time we discussed this about 3 or 4 months ago is that if I had been asked at that time, the likelihood of an impeachment process being successful, I would have given it about a zero probability because it appeared that the president had co-opted the two decision-making institutions, the Supreme Court and the United States Senate. I think that situation is beginning to change. Just last week, the Chief Justice did something that was truly unprecedented. He went public and spoke out against a sitting president, a president who's a member of the party with which the Chief Justice identifies, and spoke out in favor of judicial independence. We're all lawyers here. We know that the biggest mistake you can make when you go into litigation is to alienate the judge. The Senate, obviously, a stronger majority now after the midterm elections, but with all of the crises that are hitting all at once, there comes a tipping point where senators may begin to look at Donald Trump and identification with Donald Trump as a political liability rather than an asset. So we are heading in a direction where Donald Trump's seat, I think, is more precarious than it was.
We've been talking about the Mueller investigation, and where we left off is the discussion of whether the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, would try to compel Donald Trump to testify. He's already promulgated answers to written questions. One of the earlier questions I asked is about the effect of one House of Congress shifting away. And, of course, any investigation or impeachment begins with the House of Representatives. So let's circle back in that context to the effect of one House of Congress shifting away. What will become the Congress's role in all this, given that there's now a Democratic lower house?
Well, I think the president is in for a different experience, so to speak. Certainly for the past 2 years, we have had a government federally that has been controlled and run, at least with regards to the White House and the Congress, by the same party. And even with control of the White House and even with control of both chambers of Congress, the president has not always been able to get done what he has wanted to do, just based on divisions and differences within his own party. And so that should obviously foreshadow some of the difficulties that he is going to face now that Democrats, having won 40 seats in the most recent midterm elections, are now going to take over control of the House. Certainly, one of the primary things that we're going to see are investigations. You know, we have Elijah Cummings from Maryland, who is going to be the new chair of the House Committee on Government Reform and Oversight. We have Gerald Nadler of New York, who is going to be the new chair of the Judiciary Committee, both of whom are experienced investigators, both of whom have already indicated that they plan a more robust form of checking this particular president. And so we have that issue in and of itself. But we also have sort of the broader issue in terms of the president having to work with members of the other party. I think for any of the listeners who watched the president in a meeting with Speaker-designate Pelosi and Leader Chuck Schumer as they talked about the government shutdown, we saw the president, I believe, recognizing for the first time that he simply couldn't dictate what an outcome ought to be. And of course, now we're in a period with a government shutdown. So it's going to be a fascinating 2 years, both because of the change in leadership in the House, and then certainly with regards to the upcoming presidential election. I would add one more thing with regards to the House, and that is, you know, Speaker Pelosi or Speaker-designate Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, for that matter, have indicated to the president, both in person and in press releases, that they are willing to work with the president on things upon which they agree. They've mentioned things like prescription drug prices. They've mentioned things like infrastructure. And so it will be interesting to see whether or not the president takes them up on that offer and or whether either of them choose to work with the president on that. But the context within which all of this will be occurring is fascinating, because certainly neither of the individuals involved or neither of the three individuals involved are going to want to do anything that is going to dramatically upset their supporters as we head into a presidential election year. My hope is that all of the parties involved will choose to do what is in the best interest of the country, which is to cooperate with one another.
Dean, I'm going to let that be the last word for a moment. You're listening to Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this.
Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of your law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. Or visit sfbar.org for more information.
Dean, where we just broke, you just heard Jamal's comments about what's happening given the change of leadership, the fact that one House of Congress has gone to the opposition party from the perspective of the president. What are your views? Do you think that changes the dynamics at all?
Oh, it changes the dynamics tremendously. And let me put on my political analyst hat for a moment. Since 2016, we've had both houses controlled by Republicans. That's changed now. We now have a Republican Senate, and we'll soon have a Democratic House of Representatives. From a negotiation standpoint, they need each other. It takes two houses to pass a law, to change policy. The Republican senators need the House. The House Democrats need those Republican senators. So this is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for either some classic reaching across the aisle negotiation and compromise, which we haven't seen in a decade or so, or it's a recipe for complete stalemate. I don't know which way that's going to go. Leaders like Nancy Pelosi are very good at that political bargaining process, and we hope that something will actually get done. I think the larger problem is that in the House of Representatives, which is where any impeachment process would originate, bill of impeachment comes originally from the House of Representatives. The larger problem is, I think, within the majority party, within the Democratic Party, because we have a number of new, fresh congressmen and congresswomen. The Democratic side of the House of Representatives looks a lot more like America in the 21st century than the rest of the Congress. The rest of the Congress is primarily middle-aged to old white men. The Democratic delegation now is diverse ethnically, racially, sexually, culturally. And the question is Nancy Pelosi, as good a leader as she is she going to be able to hold that Democratic coalition together? Is she going to be able to exercise enough party discipline to actually get things done? And right now, it looks like the party is divided. Some people want to vigorously pursue investigations of Donald Trump and everything associated with Trump. They want to go full bore ahead with impeachment. I think there are other voices in the party that want to take a more moderate course, that worry about the backlash to pursuing impeachment, and want to see some negotiation, some forming of coalitions, some reaching across the aisle, and to change the image of Congress into that of an institution that gets something done. So we really don't know where that's going. Maybe there is sufficient resources for both, but in a lot of ways, those two strategies are contradictory. And what I think we need to see is we need to see a strong, coherent strategy on the part of the Democrats who now represent the majority in the House of Representatives.
I'm Jeff Hayden, and you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. where we are looking at the upcoming presidential year with Jamal Anderson. Jamal has extensive experience in Washington, D.C. and on Capitol Hill before serving locally as a deputy San Mateo County District Attorney, and with Dean Johnson, an Emmy-nominated legal analyst and commentator on television and radio of both legal and political matters. You may call regarding any question on the topic, not limited to the exact point we may be at in the conversation. The phone number to us here in the studio is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Don't be shy, even if you're calling from outside of the local dialing area. We do have a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. One of where we left off before the break, we answered the question, what might happen when, given the change of power, at least one House of Congress has moved away from the president's party. One thing that has not reared its head yet is the president's pardon power. I think the first question may be more of a political one than a legal one, but let's talk a bit about the president's power to pardon individuals. It may be those that have already been sentenced. It may be those that have a stake in the game. But do you think we're going to see much of that start to emerge?
Well, we've discussed that, and we've been discussing it for a long time. As far as the president pardoning other people, the time for that, at least with people who have been indicted or pled or are cooperating with authorities, has sort of passed. There may be other indictments coming down the road. I think there probably will be. These are going to be people who I think will be closer to the president than those who have already been charged criminally. So we may see the president having to face the alternative of pardoning people who are very, very close to him. That becomes a political calculation, and pardoning people who are under investigation, under indictment for serious crimes against the United States can reap a political firestorm. The more fascinating question is, could the president pardon himself?
We'll get there in a moment.
Sure.
We have a call coming in. Before I take the call, I want you to be thinking, formulating another question with regard to the pardon power. And that is, there are those who argue that the power to pardon is absolute and that that would protect anything that the president does. And similarly, that the entire Justice Department being underneath the president, he could determine pretty much anything that he decides is in the national interest. There's others that would say, no, when you start sending out signals that if you are friendly, you may be in my good stead and may look at a pardon, and others are painted as evil if they're opposed to him. Is that misuse of the pardon power itself something that bears some consequence, or is it pardon power absolute? Before you answer that question, though, where I want you to be thinking about, I would like to entertain a call from Kevin in San Francisco. Welcome, you're on Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I don't want to take us off the topic of pardon, so you can sort of bookmark my question if you wish. But mine was about, and forgive me if you've covered this, but the options for Robert Mueller, if someone like Whitaker or Barr choose to suppress the report or hamper him, hamper this budget, has been speculated, other possibilities they can do to just sort of hide or damage the investigation results.
Jamal, you look like that struck a chord. Are you familiar with that and you want to take a jump?
Sure, I'll take a go at that. So certainly, Kevin, you're referring to Matthew Whitaker, who is currently the acting attorney general, appointed by the president after serving as chief of staff to the former attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who recused himself at the outset of the Mueller investigation, and who incidentally was not or has not been without controversy in his new role based on previous statements that he's made with regards to the investigation. And then, of course, you're making reference to William Barr, who the president has indicated he will nominate to serve as the next Attorney General, William Barr, having previously served as Attorney General during the George H.W. administration. It is an interesting question, and the answer, as is the case with many things, is that we simply don't know. I mean, Dean has mentioned a number of times that we are a bit in uncharted territory. As the investigation was originally unfolding, based on Jeff Sessions' recusal, Rod Rosenstein, the number two in the Justice Department, was overseeing the Mueller investigation. And by all indications, he was playing it straight down the middle, providing the information to Congress and the press as needed. There's no indication that he was taking any steps to impede the investigation. But with the elevation of Matthew Whitaker, who many have suggested was handpicked by the president to potentially impede the investigation, there becomes an open question. From a political standpoint, there are a lot of commentators who have suggested that it would be a very difficult thing to justify for either Matthew Whitaker or William Barr to keep from the public and or Congress, which he may not be able to do by virtue of the way in which the statute authorizing the special counsel was created, to keep that information from the public. Now, that's not to say that there isn't information that will certainly need to be redacted, given the sensitivity of the investigation. But the odds are that the public is going to get some information with regards to the findings of the Mueller investigation. The question really is how much information and when. Based on the import nationally of the Mueller investigation, I think it's pretty hard to believe that the public won't ultimately see some version of a report.
Yeah, I think that's right. Again, we're facing the questions of, from a legal standpoint, could it happen? The way the statute's written, any attempt to suppress the report, as opposed to simply redacting very sensitive information, would be illegal. Will it happen? I don't think so, because the political backlash, the firestorm from suppressing that report that everyone is waiting for, the questions that would follow on that, I think would just be unacceptable to anyone who is a sitting president or to his administration. So I don't think it's going to be a problem. Even the redacted parts can go to the Congress to be reviewed behind closed doors. So I don't see that as happening. I think the Mueller report is certainly going to be one of the huge stories of the coming year. And by the way, in terms of the timing, the Trump administration did say that it would be an embarrassment to the White House and to the president if the Mueller report didn't come out and totally exonerate the president by the end of the year. And they were talking about last year. So we're about a year behind right now.
Seems to me they also promised that we would see it in October. There's no way they could go on past October because it would influence the election. Therefore, the report is forthcoming, and maybe they mean the presidential election. I don't know.
Yeah.
Kevin, did you have a follow-up or any further questions you wanted to ask us?
I do. Thank you. And so even though that's reassuring what you said, I'm just curious, based on the statute, can Robert Mueller, and knowing Robert Mueller's a by-the-book kind of guy and sort of, as you say, impeccable in his credentials and the way he conducts business, would he go directly to Congress? Does anything he has to say or show have to go through the Attorney General?
Anything that he has will go, first of all, to the people who are supervising the investigation, Deputy Attorney General and the Acting Attorney General, even though there's no such thing as an Acting Attorney General, which is a whole different legal issue. But it will also go to Congress. And if I know my Robert Mueller's, and I think I do, I think part of the reason for his timing is that he wants this to go to Congress. He probably wants it to go to the new Congress that will be deciding what to do with the information. And as a good public servant, I think he firmly believes that making a decision that potentially would depose the chief executive is not his to make. I think he's going to let the information come out, make it as public as he possibly can, and then let the chips fall where they may.
Thank you.
Kevin, thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights.
Thank you.
I can see we're barely scratching the surface in this huge amount of material we have to go through. Both of you, think about what you're doing next week if you'd like to resume. But for now, let's return to the subject of pardons. How absolute do you think, Jamal, is the power to pardon?
Well, I think the pardon to powers is fairly absolute. I think the more interesting question is a political question, and certainly if there is an issue with regards to pardons that are issued, they certainly will be litigated. I think what we have seen, and it's important for us to look back historically, at least within the past 2 years, is we have seen that this president is one who is unmoored by history with regards to who he is choosing to pardon and when. We go back and we look at Sheriff Joe Arpaio, former sheriff of Maricopa County in Arizona, who was convicted and was awaiting sentencing, pardoned by this particular president. We look at Scooter Libby, who was convicted during the Bush administration, pardoned by this president. We look at Dwight Howard and Stephen Howard up in Oregon, pardoned by this president. And even though there was some backlash initially, it didn't seem to be enough backlash to have any long-term, at least as far as we know, political consequences for this president. And so if past is prologue, it seems that the president would not hesitate to pardon individuals involved in this particular investigation. And if we read the tea leaves, or at least read the tweets that have been sent by the president, we can see that he certainly has some favorites. I would reference you certainly to his treatment of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn in talking about his involvement and his prosecution in this particular case, the way in which he's referenced him as being a good man, a family man who was apparently caught up by the Federal Bureau investigation. This was alluded to by Mr. Flynn's attorneys, suggesting that perhaps Michael Flynn was unaware that lying to the FBI was a crime. And you contrast that with the president's statements about Michael Cohen, who he has referred to as a rat. There is an open question as to why there is a difference. Some would argue it has to do with the information that's being provided by both of those individuals. But I do not think the president would hesitate to pardon either of them, or particularly Mr. Flynn, if he saw that it was in his best interest. And if there was an issue, I think, of course, it would be litigated.
Dean, I'm going to turn it to you and ask you to answer the same question, but I'd like to throw in another element to keep in mind, and that is, we've been talking about prosecutions under federal law of people that have been convicted in federal court. And when you've answered that, I'd like you to jump into state prosecutions and talk a little bit about the difference and what power the president does or doesn't have.
Well, first of all, you know, if the president has held on to this pardon power, if he were going to pardon Flynn or Cohen, the time to do it was before they started singing like canaries to the federal prosecutors. And he would have taken away any incentive that they would have had to provide information that may lead to the prosecution of people very close to Trump or indeed to Trump himself. But to answer the question, no, the president's pardon power is not absolute. He has complete discretion to pardon anyone of any federal crime. But there are two limitations on that power. First of all, I believe that the better reading of the framers' intent is that he can't pardon himself. So that's not on the table. Secondly, the Constitution is very specific that this pardon power extends only to federal crimes. And one thing that I think Trump and Trump associates have to fear is something that, that hasn't happened yet, is state law prosecutions for some of the things that are alleged to have been done by Trump, by the Trump Foundation, by Trump associates like Michael Cohen. The logical place to put those state prosecutions would be in the state of New York. Eric Schneiderman, the former Attorney General of New York, made his career suing Donald Trump and getting millions of dollars from Trump University. He is now out of office and replaced by Barbara Underwood, who I think probably likes Trump even less than Schneiderman did. So that would be a good place to venue a state prosecution. New York has a statute that bars, in effect, double jeopardy prosecution under federal law and state law. But if no jeopardy has attached, if Trump or a Trump associate hasn't been prosecuted federally, then the states are free to go forward with that prosecution. So those are limitations on the pardon power and the interplay between the pardon power, state prosecutions, federal prosecutions. Double jeopardy is part of a game of three-dimensional chess that I think will see its opening gambit when the Mueller report ultimately comes down.
Well, I think Dean is absolutely correct, and I would add that Bob Mueller has been very direct and clear about unloading, so to speak, some of the investigations with regards to the individuals involved. I would note with regards to Paul Manafort, for example, that Paul Manafort went to trial. He was convicted of 8 counts, and there was a hung jury with regards to the remaining counts. But when Mr. Manafort pled or entered into a plea agreement with regards to his open case in the District of Columbia, Bob Mueller forced him or asked him to admit to multiple violations, which would certainly subject him to prosecution either in Virginia or in New York. And so even if the president were to pardon Paul Manafort, he would certainly still be subject to prosecutions there. I would note with regards to Dean's point about New York, we again have Barbara Underwood, who stepped in for Attorney General Schneiderman, former Solicitor General in New York, who will be returning to that role now that New York has elected a new Attorney General, Letitia James. And she has been very forward about indicating the types of investigations that she will undergo once she becomes the Attorney General in January. So certainly there are a lot of options available in the event that the president chooses to pardon these individuals. But again, that pardon power is with regards to federal crimes, not state crimes.
And, you know, I think Mueller is a very smart guy. That's probably an understatement. I am sure that he's gamed all this out. There was a snippet very early on when I was commenting on the Mueller investigation. There was just a snippet of news that indicated that even though there's secrecy surrounding the investigation, Mueller has shared information with state attorneys general. That would not surprise me. I think Mueller may have figured this out to the point that possibly he thinks the federal investigation will go nowhere. But if there are crimes out there that remain unprosecuted, Mueller is a prosecutor at heart, and he would have no problem with cooperating with state investigations, which could become the Trump administration's worst nightmare.
One thing I am curious about, state prosecutions, some states bar them when there's been a federal prosecution. They consider that double jeopardy. How does a presidential pardon fit into all this? Does that take it outside the gambit, erase the entirety of the prosecution?
Well, it kind of depends on when the pardon comes along. If someone is simply indicted and then immediately pardoned, jeopardy hasn't attached yet. The defendant hasn't been subjected to criminal jeopardy. That only happens when the trial begins or when the first juror is seated. So, again, it's a game of chess. If you hold off on the pardon until after jeopardy is attached, until after there's a conviction, until after there's a sentence, there is an argument that there are state laws that would prevent further prosecution by state attorneys general. There's also a case before the Supreme Court right now called Gamble versus the United States that would constitutionalize the notion of separate sovereignties and would say that if you've been prosecuted by the state or the federal authorities, the other authority can't prosecute you. So there can't be successive multiple prosecutions for the same act. That has yet to be decided, and the law is up in the air. So, again, multiple dimensions to this game.
I think that's going to be the last word on the subject for tonight. Before, I'd like to give you each a couple moments to sum up any last-minute thoughts, any concluding thoughts. But before you do, as you both know, we have barely scratched the surface. We had a lot of material to go through tonight. We didn't have time for many calls because there's so much material to go through. And I would like to invite each of you to see if you're available to come back next week and complete the discussion.
Happy to be here, Jeff. Anytime.
And Jamal, are you available next week to complete the discussion?
Unfortunately, I will not be here. I'll be out of the country, but I will listen from afar.
If you would like to call in, I could arrange that as well. With that, would you like to have any concluding thoughts?
Well, thank you for having me. I think I would like to conclude by simply emphasizing the critical juncture that we're in, certainly now as a country, obviously discussing the Mueller investigation, which has brought us to uncharted territory. But we did fortunately have an opportunity to talk about the change in the power dynamics in Washington, D.C., with Democrats coming back to control the House. And so the things that I will be looking for, certainly as we talked about earlier, will be the extent to which the leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, will be able to work with this president, the extent to which the president will be willing to work with them to find issues on common ground, indicated hopefully for the country's sake, they will be able to find common ground on things that inure to the benefit of the American people. But of course, again, all of this is going to be happening within the context of a presidential campaign, which is already underway. We have a number of people who have already indicated their interest, by my count, at least six or seven United States senators, potentially some other individuals who are not senators who lost their election. Beto O'Rourke is one. Andrew Gillum in Florida is another, and potentially Stacey Abrams is another. And so we are moving into a period where anything is liable to happen. The hope is that our government will begin to function in a manner that benefits the American people, or at least benefits it more than we've seen in the past 2 years.
Dean, any closing thoughts?
You know, there's an old proverb, which I believe is attributed to Confucius, that says it's a curse to be born in interesting times. Curse or not, 2019 is, from a legal standpoint and a political standpoint, going to be the most interesting of times, a great time to be a legal analyst, and I'm looking forward to it.
I'd like to thank both of you for joining us. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. Our topic tonight has been the upcoming presidential year. My guests tonight have been Emmy-nominated legal and political analyst and Redwood City attorney Dean Johnson, the founder of Pundit Network, and Jamal H. Anderson, who, a practicing district attorney, before becoming an attorney, has lived in Washington and worked extensively both in Washington, D.C. and Capitol Hill. We'll be back next week with Your Legal Rights, where we will conclude the discussion of the upcoming presidential year. Again, you're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Our thanks to you for listening. And at the controls for the vacationing Joanne Marr, Debbie Kennedy, our thanks to you. I'm Jeff Hayden, and thank you again for listening. And have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.